Great.
Thanks, Veronica. So we are going to be talking about things in a paper that came out last week. It's great to be talking about this with a paper to hold on to, rather than just promising things. So apologies to those of you who've seen some version of this talk before. This hopefully will be an opportunity for people to speak up a little bit, and when there's something that's not comprehensible and so forth, we can have a bit of discussion and make sure we go through things at the right pace so we can grasp the key points. And really the aim of this is that I'm going to set up Don to talk about all the good stuff, which is in here. But to get to the good stuff, which is talking about black hole interiors and information paradoxes in relation to replicable wormholes and page curves and so forth, there's a bit of sort of a formalism to go through about the way we like to think about things, and then a model where we can really crank everything through and solve it that has some of the features that we think are really important in this context of black holes and so forth. It'll be really crucial points for what Don's going to speak about. So I'll talk about these first two things, and I'll try and be as swift as I can whilst keeping things comprehensible to give Don enough time. Okay, so what's the general perspective? We've learned recently from this work about getting a page curve from semi-classical gravity that, as pointed out in the East Coast papers and West Coast papers in December, that a crucial role is being played in these by geometries that connect many asymptotically ADS boundaries. And this is related to very old work by Giddings and Strominger and Coleman in the late 80s and early 90s and others who related this to the physics of baby universes, which is some closed universes, and random couplings was, I think, how it was described in those days, or in kind of more modern language, an ensemble of boundary theories. So really, we wanted to connect these circle of ideas together. So the starting point is to just talk about what the gravitational path integral looks like with wormholes with the language of sort of ADS-CFT and so forth. So when you first learn about ADS-CFT, the first thing you might see is a definition of, or some definition of, the duality, which might look something like this. So on the right-hand side, we have some, say, gravitational path integral with some field phi and some action. And then there's some set of boundary conditions. So we're going to work our way through this list of things. So the first thing you have is some set of boundary conditions, which is maybe an asymptotic metric or conformal metric and some, say, non-normalizable parts of fields and so forth. And if you compute this path integral on the right-hand side, what you're supposed to land on is the partition function of some dual conformal field theory. But now if we have, let's suppose we have two boundaries, we can have some sources J1 on this boundary and sources J2 on this boundary. So the first thing I've got to do is tell you what a space-time wormhole is. And that means it's a configuration that connects two pieces like this. This is what we mean by a space-time wormhole. There's some tube that goes through here that connects these two. And because we have, naively at least, these sorts of configurations in the path integral, they can be solutions, but they need not be solutions. They're there in the path integral. It means that if I compute something like this, with two boundaries now, then these configurations mean this is not a product of the two pieces. Each individual piece just contains disconnected pieces, and the product contains this new connected piece, so there's a difference. So there's a challenge of how to interpret that. All I'm going to do for now is write down some notation. This left-hand side I'm going to define as the path integral with these sets of boundary conditions. And the angle brackets remind us that this need not split into a product of its components. And in examples recently, like in JT gravity, this has a nice interpretation as an ensemble average over different theories, and we're going to make contact with that later.
Is there a reason you don't just write it as C with an argument J1, J2 instead of introducing what looks like confusion?
Try to make the notation as not confusing as possible. So this Z of J is what we would normally think of as a partition function of a single theory with some particular set of sources. So if this was an ensemble of theories, then Z of J is the... So for example, in JD gravity, this is Z of beta. It's the partition function with some particular temperature. But there's not a single theory. So that means that this Z of J is actually a random variable. And it has, because there are two of these now, it has a non-trivial covariance matrix. So this is really you can think of this as an average of a random variable. And that's, the notation is supposed to reflect that. I hope that's...
Also, you're trying to think of them as things like annihilation and creation operators, in a sense.
I think not necessarily a useful way to think about them. We'll get to that eventually. But okay, where were we? Good. Okay, so this is the notation we've chosen. I hope it's the least possible confusing notation, but we may have failed. We borrowed it from Phil and Steve and Douglas, so we can blame them. I think they chose a very good notation. Okay, so this is our path integral. I shouldn't have rubbed off that picture. I'm about to use it. Okay, so I'll just draw the same picture again, but rotated slightly. So I have some boundary down here with some source J1, and another boundary here with a source J2. The way we're going to put some structure on this is by thinking about this as a quantum mechanics, and think about some, we've got two boundaries, and we have some set of states that are actually propagating in between them. So in other words, I want to describe this as an amplitude by cutting it and inserting a complete set of states. But the thing that's flowing here is some closed universe. Now, so what I need to talk about is a Hilbert space of closed universes. So that's what I'm going to construct. We call it baby universe Hilbert space because you can think of this as some big parent universe down here where we're computing something, and in the process of computing something, this little closed universe baby splits off and is produced, and it comes along, and then eventually it joins onto another large parent universe up here. And the fact that there are these space-time wormholes presumably means that this Hilbert space is actually non-trivial, and there's some interesting sum over states going on in the middle. The challenge, if we really want to describe a Hilbert space of closed universes, is the usual one, is that we've got diffeomorphism invariants. The usual way to approach this is that you have some set of configurations, and then there's a Hamiltonian constraint which gives you a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and you identify the different sorts of different sorts of closed universe. But with these wormholes, now these universes can start actually splitting and joining with each other, and the fact that we have this topology change makes this kind of a fairly formidable challenge that we're actually going to sidestep completely. And the way we're going to sidestep it is by imagining populating this space of closed universes really at the asymptotic boundary. So what we do is this is one of the things that ADS asymptotics are going to help us do in a pin down. So this gives me the next set of things in my dictionary, is that I can define states like this, Z of J1 up to Z of JM, and this state is defined as something where I have m boundaries, 1, 2, up to m, and I have sources j1 here, j2 here, up to jm here, and then there's some path integral over configurations. And roughly speaking, if I had some particular way of describing my closed universes in the middle, sort of using the old the sort of Wheeler-DeWitt technology and so forth, there might be some set of field configurations. And I could describe the matrix elements between some particular field configuration and this initial state, in other words, the wave function of this state, as a path integral, where I define, so this is the wave function, and I define this as a path integral where I have these m boundaries in the past, which are asymptotically ADS, and my particular field configuration somewhere in here, and I just do the path integral. So that's the definition of these states, or at least a sort of informal way to think about the definition of these states. And
sorry, is the field phi is a matter field, or is it including the...
So this would have to include metrics and matter fields and so forth, and it would have to be sort of a set of solutions to the Wheeler equation and so forth. This is a... Because we're not going to really have to discuss this set of field configurations, this is just a sort of informal way of thinking about what this is doing. So this is just... something that generalizes a Hodle-Hawking state, a no-boundary state, which is where you don't have any boundaries in the past, and then you define the wave function on a three-sphere by integrating over everything that doesn't have any boundaries. So now we're just connecting in these path boundaries. There's a special thing in the Hodle-Hawking state. There's one...
Fire fields living on this slice.
This is, yeah, some sort of field living on this slice that I've gauge fixed in some way.
Disconnected as well.
And this could be disconnected, yes. So this, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so this is, my next point is that this Hodle-Hawking state is different in one way from what you would normally think of as the Hodle-Hawking state, because it doesn't necessarily describe just one component universe. It could describe no universes whatsoever. There's some amplitude for nothing to happen. Or several different connected components of universes.
Well, it's easy to picture this in one dimension. How would you possibly describe this in, say, four dimensions where you'd have three manifolds?
We're really describing all these field configurations and classifying all the manifolds and so forth? I don't know, but I don't have to. I can anchor myself down.
So why don't you have to?
So I'm going to presume from on high that someone has given me a set of asymptotic boundary conditions that I'm allowed. So this would include, say, a space of asymptotic three manifolds and sources and so forth. And I'm just going to say that this is a set of states. It's a bit abstract, but this is a set of states that I can...
Even though you couldn't enumerate them.
I would struggle to enumerate them, yeah. Yes.
So I'm not sure what it means. Now, as long as you need to define this, you can't describe what high is.
Okay, well, I can't. So this is an informal way of thinking about things. The real definition is that there is an abstract thing that I'll define as a state, which is just labeled by some unordered set of possible boundary conditions. And the next thing I have to tell you then is what the inner product on this set of states is. And the inner product is something that I can describe by... So I have another one of these states with J twiddle 1 in the future up to J... Twiddle m, and then I do the path integral in the future to define the wave function of this, the path integral in the past to define the wave function of this, and then I integrate over all the possible intermediate states. But all that does is glue everything together, if I've done everything in the right way, so that actually there's some path integral that describes how these things join, some complicated thing, I'm not going to fill in all the details, but in the end... Well, I've written the answer over here, so I don't have to now. In the end, the overlap of two of these states, the inner product between them, is defined as a path integral with these n boundaries sort of in the future, and m boundaries in the past, so to speak, and I just do the path integral with those boundaries. And the guys in the future, there's some CPT conjugate, but this isn't mine.
Including all topologies?
And this would be an integral, yeah, where we do the full path integral over all possible topologies. Yes.
So,
We're presumed very powerful for this abstract.
Some kind of completeness, the intermediate states which you haven't defined must include all the possible asymptotic states.
Good, yeah. So, I haven't yet told you these are all the states, but I think it's at least plausible that this really is a set of all states. If you were to describe a state of closed universes that you're interested in, over here in some perhaps semi-classical way, here's your universe, and it's got some matter fields and so forth. If I have negative cosmological constant, and I evolve this thing in Euclidean time, so in Lorentzian time this would collapse, typically, but in Euclidean time, it typically expands in the future and past, and eventually expands to some asymptotic boundary, and then there's some particular boundary conditions that I could assign here to create this universe. So at least plausibly, it contains everything you might like to think about, but that doesn't really matter for us in the end. If we really want to, it's the set of states that we're interested in from the point of view of asymptotic.
Do you know this gives a positive metric on the Hilbert space?
Good. Everyone's asking the right questions.
Because, just in two-dimensional string world sheet, it fails outside the critical dimension.
Good. So that will be our key assumption, which is I'm going to write it down.
So, various things can, say, locally collapse or whatever. You don't know that anything you start with is going to go into an asymptotic EPS.
That's certainly true. There's no guarantee that this is going to give you the entire Hilbert space of closed universes, but in the end, it certainly gives you the set of closed universes that that take part in these sorts of processes between asymptotic boundaries by construction. So there may be other states that I can't create, but I can't create them, so never mind.
Well, no, there could be little intermediate branches where something splits off and collapses or something.
Absolutely, and they would be described as part of this wave function. So because I'm defining these things at asymptotic boundaries, then if I were able to sort of solve the Wheeler-Ode equation and ask about what the evolution looks like, I may find that it looks like a collapsing universe, and that's fine. But it's all defined at these asymptotic boundaries where we know what we're doing. So to answer Mark's question, we don't know that it's going to give us a positive definite inner product. But this is going to be the one big assumption that we're putting in. That the inner product that we build like this is positive semi-definite.
And you don't worry that this will fail on the string world outside the critical.
I can't say I've thought about that example specifically. That example wouldn't fit into our. Okay, there would be differences, and we would struggle to define the Hilbert space if it's not positive. But this is something that would apply, for example, if you were to ask semi-classically, looking at Hawking's approximation where he looked at the black hole evaporation of quantum fields on a fixed background, that would obey this version of reflection positivity. So it's not, we're not putting everything in by doing this. But there's an interesting question as to how do you guarantee this is true and when is it true? And if this fails to be true, then it means that the quantum mechanics of closed universes is not quantum mechanics. Okay. So this is, it's just saying that the amplitudes of closed universes have a quantum mechanical description, standard quantum mechanical description.
That comes from the Euclidean method.
So the assumption is that the set of amplitudes that are this set of amplitudes interpreted as quantum mechanics of closed universes is a quantum mechanics.
Is it Euclidean calculation?
Maybe I should make a comment about Euclidean versus. Yeah, so it's easier to think about what these amplitudes are when these boundaries and the spacetimes are Euclidean, and it's easiest to draw the pictures, but that is not a necessary restriction, and I'd like to think about these sources as containing, for example, a Euclidean section that prepares some state, then a Lorentzian section that does real-time evolution. You can describe, for example, the sorts of experiments where you couple this to some external system using this kind of language with real-time evolution, and then some Euclidean thing defining the final state. That will be included, and then this path integral would have to include a Lorentzian or perhaps complex metrics. So that's that we can...
But your boundary conditions are restricted to Euclidean?
The boundary conditions are not restricted to Euclidean. Yeah. The boundary conditions can include Lorentzian time evolution, for example.
What does refraction particle mean?
It means this. It means that the inner product that we define in this way, like this, is positive semi-definite, which means that if I compute the overlap of any two states, which is not just these particular states of Z's, but any superposition of those states, I compute norms, all those norms have to be non-negative. It can be zero, which we're going to fix up in a moment.
It's worth mentioning this ability to impose complex boundary conditions is a potential way of dealing with the kind of issue that Steve was mentioning. You might have a universe which classically collapses in Lorentz signature, or you might have one which collapses in Euclidean signature. Maybe it happens in both, although collapse of Euclidean signature is certainly correlated with expansion of Lorentz signature and so forth. But you can imagine that there's some complex section through that spacetime that still has a nice boundary. So it gives you more freedom to deal with those issues.
Sorry, what do you mean, collapse?
I would mean that in Lorentz signature, the spacetime doesn't have good past and future boundaries, or in Euclidean signature, it doesn't have good past and future boundaries.
Okay, so our next step is I've defined an inner product, at least a set of states and some bilinear product between the two things, and I've asserted or assumed that this is a positive semi-definite inner product. There's now a canonical way to actually build a Hilbert space. So, and the quantum field theory aficionados will be familiar with this from the Whiteman or Osterwalder-Schrader reconstruction theorems, and all you have to do is take the completion of the span of these states, C of J, 1, etc. States, and you define the completion. Okay, so this is defined in some way, but roughly speaking, we can think of this completion as just a set of infinite sums of these things that have some convergent norm. But something that's important in this is that I can have null states that appear. So a sum over I with some coefficient ci with z j I say 1 up to z j I m I, something like this. And this, in the completion, turns out to be the zero state. So in other words, if I compute this norm by the inner product of the basis elements and add everything up, I turn out to get exactly zero. And this is giving me, I can read this as some equivalence between states that naively look like they're different states, turn out to be the same state.
Sorry, what, in the completion it's zero, or are you quotient by the null states and then it's zero?
There are various ways to think about this. In the completion, in this construction, they're automatically defined as zero.
Doesn't sound like what completion normally means.
Okay, so the completion of these states is defined as the set of equivalence classes of Cauchy sequences, This is a Cauchy sequence, if you like. If you truncate the sum at some finite order and take the sum to infinity, that defines the partial sums define a Cauchy sequence, and they're in the same equivalence class as the zero sequence. Okay, this is a technicality, but maybe another way to think about it is that you define the states as these sums, where you just constrain these coefficients by saying that this sum should converge, and then I quotient by states with zero norm. It's roughly equivalent thing.
So this equivalence relation, does it go beyond the diffeomorphism symmetry? And so if that's the case, is it, for example, symmetry of the Einstein-Hilbert action coupled with matter, or is it something very quantum? What is the nature of this gate symmetry?
Everyone is asking all the right questions. Yeah. So I haven't actually said the words gate symmetry yet, but yeah. So this is it's nice to think about the appearance of null states as being due to some gate symmetry. That's right. The equivalence. And this is effectively the diffeomorphism invariant symmetry, except it's really sort of an extension of that, because you can think of these things as being due to the fact that I can start with a single universe, and with wormholes, it can split into two. But I could equally well decide to describe this state at this slice, the Fickert-Cauchy slice, and say there's one universe. Or I can describe it with a slice up here and say there's two universes. But these are not, these are gauge equivalent. It's a choice of slicing. So what this is telling me is that that there are linear relations between states with a single universe, states with two universes, and so forth. So it's due to this sort of time slice. This is not an ordinary diffeomorphism because it relates these two things, but it's a very natural extension of diffeomorphism invariance. It's describing this. And this looks like a technicality, but this is going to turn out to be the really central kind of new feature that we encounter that's going to be really important.
Well, so you're saying that this is sort of a diffeomorphism, but it's really a question of whether the baby universe Hilbert space, is it a diffeomorphism invariant concept? Because you choose a slice, right, so when you cut it.
So the baby universe Hilbert space, because I've described it really at this asymptotic boundary, because it's described in this asymptotic way, then this is somewhere where topology change and so forth gets suppressed. So I really have this gauge invariant definition, but something with a slicing in the middle where the universes have finite size that you might use in the normal semi-classical way, that is, unless you're very clever and you can find some clever method to gauge fix, that is not a gauge invariant way of talking about things. So things like the number of connected components, spatial connected components of a universe, is not a gauge invariant observable, for example, because of precisely this reason.
What's the quantum mechanical interpretation for this condition? It's down here.
What's the quantum mechanical interpretation? This is telling you that there are states that you create with, look like they're different boundary conditions. You create different states, but in fact, in the full Hilbert space, they are the same state. So it's think of it as a gauge equivalent, if you like.
So your set of J's had some redundancies?
So
that's what you were assuming?
Yes, well, it's a little... there's some sort of overcompleteness in the set of states that you can create with boundaries like this. Yes.
Could I choose to not have the overcompleteness? Could I choose to start with a set of J's which define distinct?
So in the toy model, we're going to start with a very minimal set of things, and we're going to find that there's this massive gauge of variance.
Two dimensions which you're drawing on the blackboard.
Yes.
It looks like one J is enough. It connects to anything. Any product of circles?
We might want to create states with different matter and so forth. In the in a specific example of JT gravity, there the asymptotic boundaries contain J is a single number, it's beta, the renormalized length of the boundary, and I think you need all betas to populate this space of baby universes. I'm not totally sure about
that.
Because they create universes of different sizes.
Your beta, just one circle.
So you need many copies of circles, because you could have some. Yeah, so you certainly need all of these. One circle is not enough. Because there could be many. Roughly speaking, Each circle has some small amplitude of creating many universes, but in some particular superposition of wave functions. If I really want to describe all possible states of universes, to have enough control over the independent variables, the independent states of universes, I need to have include multiple boundaries so that I can independently change the wave functions of different universes. You can see this in examples.
Is there any other way of describing the Silbert space?
Sort of L2 function. So in some semi-classical limit, you can describe it. Hopefully we'll get to the example and we can describe exactly what the Hilbert space is in that example. Which will probably help. Perhaps we're nearly at the end of this part one, so let's finish that, and then any more questions we can postpone until then. So these boundaries play one more role, which is as operators. And roughly speaking, I think of this operator as I have some initial state, and I have some final state of closed universes, and if I want to compute the matrix element of this operator, I do the path integral with all configurations between initial states and final states, except I glue in some extra boundary that's allowed to take part. So this has some source J, this is an asymptotic boundary, so I can, this operator is defined as being an extra insertion in the path integral. So that means it's defined like this. I take Z of J acting on one of my basis states, and I just add this into the state. This hopefully is at least vaguely visible from over there. Okay, so this is some set of operators. These have some extremely important properties. If I take two of these, they commute. And this you can sort of see from this picture. If I insert one of these boundaries and insert another one of these boundaries later, there's no inherent time ordering between these things. There's no inherent thing. It comes back to the fact that when I define these states with some number of boundaries, there's no preferred ordering of these boundaries. So they're by construction, these things commute. And I now have a large set of commuting observables in quantum mechanics. So my gut reaction from kindergarten quantum mechanics is I should diagonalize them. So that's what I do. So these things, the fact that these commute in particular means that this commutes with its Hermitian conjugate, which means that I can actually simultaneously diagonalize these things. And that means that I find some states, which I'll call alpha, which are simultaneous eigenstates of these guys. And this is true for all sources J. Okay.
The commutativity really, it just comes from the formal definition, in a sense.
Yes. Yes. Sure.
But this stage, there isn't. It was interchangeable what you called initial and final and what you inserted.
Yeah. The labels initial and final are sort of convenient ways to think about this as a time evolution, but they're really just labels that we assign for convenience for any particular amplitude. They don't carry some inherent meaning. Okay. So we can diagonalize, so we do it. And we have this new set of states. Which we call alpha states. And once we've diagonalized things, we can go ahead and compute any amplitude. So to compute this amplitude, V of J1 up to V of JN, I can write this as, so first of all, we have this no boundary state. I can think of this as an amplitude in a no boundary state, with Z of J1. And now I insert a complete set of alpha states in here, and Z of J2. Need some more room. And now, because these things are eigenvectors, simultaneous eigenstates, alpha 1, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 2, etc. And in the end, we have a Hartle-Hawking state.
Sorry, could you say again what the Hartle-Hawking state is?
So the Hartle-Hawking state is defined as by the path integral where you don't insert any boundaries whatsoever. So it's the n equals zero version of this, the absence of any boundaries. And then I sum over the alpha ones up to the alpha n, say. But this thing just becomes a sum over. So these things are eigenstates, so they just pull out as numbers. Then when alpha 1 hits alpha 2, because I should call this an operator. Alpha 1 then hits alpha 2, and these things are defined to be mutually orthonormal, as anything when you simultaneously diagonalize it. So I end up with only a single sum over alpha, with everything being the same. And the only amplitudes left are the Hartle-Hawking state with some alpha at the beginning and the same thing at the end. And then I have z alpha of j1 up to z alpha of jn. Okay. And if I call this thing up to some normalization factor that I won't worry about too much, if I call this thing p alpha, a probability, then we see that this has a probabilistic ensemble interpretation where the z alpha of j's are the values for these sort of partition function quantities in a particular member of the ensemble labeled by alpha.
I don't quite understand where the Hartle-Hawking state comes from, because on the left there you have n boundaries in your definition.
Yeah. So I can think of these n boundaries as being, I start with a Hartle-Hawking state, which is no boundaries, and then I throw in one of these operators, z of j1, that puts in a boundary, and I put z of j2, and so forth. So I'm describing these boundaries now by operators acting on the Hartle-Hawking state. So it's important for us that we can populate our Hilbert space by acting with these specific commuting operators on this kind of ground state. It's still part of the Hawking state. And I just wanted to say one more thing before moving on. What was the one more thing I wanted to say? I haven't written it down. Good. Yeah, okay. And the fact that this is a probability distribution just comes from the fact that all our observables are commuting, and so quantum mechanics just reduces to classical probability. Or another way of saying it is the different alpha eigenstates are super selection sectors for this set of observables. And if these are the only observables we care about, then classical probability is enough to describe their physics.
So are you assuming that the dimension of the Hilbert space is more than one?
So, good. There's a possible way that this can reduce to the ordinary story of ADS-EFT, which is that this sort of set of gauge symmetries, these null states, is so incredibly strong that every possible state you try and create is just the Hartle-Hawking state again. Then this sum collapses to a single state, everything factorizes, and we're... so that is a thing that can happen, and it will be great to understand the physics of how that works. In some
so there are arguments that the corresponding Hilbert should be one-dimensional.
I'd be interested to hear about some details of those. The suggesting that the Hilbert space of closed universes is one-dimensional is not. That has history. Okay. So this is the general structure, and I can see that I'm going to just describe the simplest of these models. That's the plan. Okay, so section two, and then it's Dom's turn. Hopefully I'll have enough time. Okay, so what we're going to describe now is a really simple model to see particularly this feature in action. And that model is going to be sort of the stupidest model of gravity you can come up with. This is a model where the set of configurations in the path integral are just topological surfaces. Okay. So, in fact, I've written down the definition of the theory up here. The only z's we have, these partition function-like quantities, the only structure that topology allows me to have is just there's a circle boundary. So there's some Z is just an insertion of a circle, and there's no J label. The set of J's is trivial. And then the definition of this path integral, this amplitude, is I sum over all possible topological surfaces with these n boundaries, and these boundaries are sort of marked, distinguishable things, just like external particles in a scattering experiment or something. And I sum over all the surfaces with n boundaries with some action. The natural action to include is the Euler characteristic, the local action, and you have to ask me about the details. It turns out to make this model nice and consistent, you have to add some extra term on the boundary that I'm not going to go into the details of because it's not really important for what I want to say. Okay, so this is the definition of the model, and it's important here that this is not just the sum over connected surfaces, it includes a sum over disconnected surfaces. So let's just do an example quickly. So I'll do an example. Okay. What do I do? Shortcuts. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to say about this model is that if I have any given connected component, then the action of this thing, if I sum over connected surfaces with any number of boundaries, I get this e to the ns naught to begin with, and then n times the Euler characteristic. I need a factor of, plus s naught times the Euler characteristic. The Euler characteristic is 2 minus twice the genus minus the number of boundaries. So the important thing here is that this cancels with this, makes our life simpler, and this is just some number lambda. You can sum this series, it's a geometric series, the value is not terribly important. It's some large number lambda if this model is semi-classical. So S naught, we're thinking of as some...
So the reason you introduce the same S naught for both is in order to get the cancellation?
It's to get this cancellation. If you want to... So in the end, once you've solved everything, there really is a principled reason for doing this. That I would have to go and solve the model and then tell you afterwards. It turns out the reflection positivity, when you have extra states at the end of the world brains, actually demands you include something like this. But that's something we can revisit afterwards. Okay, so if I sum over the topologies, the number of handles, there's some number lambda, which in the semi-classical limit I'd like to think of as being very large, exponentially large, in fact. Connected surfaces. So that means I never have to think about handles again. I just say, I look at what the connections are of any particular topology and sum over those. So in particular, this amplitude z cubed, I can have 3 boundaries. There are various terms. So there's a term where nothing connects to each other. There's a term where 2 things connect. And there are 3 of those, depending on which 2 I choose to connect. And there's a term where everything connects. So this z cubed amplitude is lambda cubed here, where I get 1 lambda for each connected component, plus 3 lambda squared, plus lambda. So this is the way these sort of things work. It's just some combinatorial problem of seeing how things connect together. Okay. So now... this is a simple example. Let's compute everything at once. So a nice way to compute everything is you compute the generating function of these correlators. So this is defined by doing a Fourier expansion, and you have some weight u. And if I just look at the coefficients of u to the n, I can read off these amplitudes. And as when I usually do Fermi diagrams, I can write this thing as exponential over over connected amplitudes. So e to the uz connected. Okay. So this is defined now as I can expand this in power series. Every time I see a z to the n, I just replace that with not all surfaces with n boundaries, but only connected surfaces with n boundaries. That always does the same thing. I've just told you that the connected surfaces with n boundaries just give you lambda. So that means in the end that I'm left with some parameter lambda. And this z doesn't do anything. Z is effectively 1. Okay. This is a sort of quite short, slick way to get all the amplitudes. But I should slightly modify this to say that I've normalized this by dividing by the expectation value of 1, which is the sum of all possible closed universes without boundaries. So that's the only extra ingredient that's coming in here. But you can check that if you expand this thing to third order and look at the lambdas, you'll get this thing. It really works. Okay. So that's the amplitudes. That was perhaps a little swift, but okay.
Am I right that the babies are bosons?
Yeah, so our asymptotic boundaries are actually distinguishable things. They're sort of labeled.
That bothers me. That's why I was asking.
Yeah. So the fact that the boundaries are distinguishable is the reason why we have there's 1 over n factorials when we expand this, and the 1 over n factorials are to compensate for the fact that these things are distinguishable. So this is why there's really 3 times these, for example. The 3 different configurations are distinct configurations.
But the argument that the z's commuted, in my mind, requires that the boundaries are indistinguishable.
They do not, because the path integral with 1 boundary labeled A and another boundary labeled B is the same as the path integral with 1 boundary labeled B and another boundary labeled A. It's the fact that the path integral has no respect for ordering that makes a difference. The fact that we label the boundaries externally doesn't change what the path integral computes. Fine. Okay, so the next thing to say now is to construct this in a product. And let's check where we are. Good. Actually, the next thing to do is probably to construct the ensemble. So I told you that this thing, that in general, the formalism here guarantees that this has some probability interpretation. So that means I can think of this z as a random variable, and this thing here is a generating function, a moment generating function for this random variable. So what I can do is I'm going to normalize everything by the expectation value of 1. So this exponential, I just expand it. So I'm going to write, I want d, so equals 0 to infinity of, so first of all, there's an e to the minus lambda that comes from this normalization, and then there's a lambda to the d over d factorial that comes from expanding these things, and times e to the u. Okay. So I identify on the left-hand side that z appears on the left-hand side in the same way that d appears on the right-hand side. So in other words, this I can think of this as being the probability that Z is equal to Z. And this is how I would compute this expectation value. So I can immediately see what this ensemble is. The ensemble is that this boundary thing, Z, takes these non-negative integer values, D. So Z is a natural number. And the weights of them are given by these things, and this is a Poisson distribution. With mean invariance lambda. Okay. And this is kind of surprising, because if we originally thought of these Z boundaries as, we originally thought of the Hilbert space as being spanned by these states Z to the n. If I take a sum of Z to the n's, it's like a power series, which I think I can build sort of any function of Z out of. So a natural way to think of the Hilbert space is all possible functions of Z. It's like L2 of Z or something. But it turns out that is not what the Hilbert space is. It's not functions of all Z, it's functions of non-negative integer Z. And there's a nice dual interpretation of this fact. And that's that if I have a circle boundary, I would normally think of this as computing the partition function on the circle, which is trace e to the minus beta h. There's no temperature here, so it's just the trace of 1. And the trace of 1 is the dimension of the Hilbert space. And d, the non-negative integer, can be the dimension of the Hilbert space.
If I replace that n times s naught with some k times s naught, how does this change?
It changes. There's some normalization factor on z that changes. So it's actually something like e to the minus s naught times an integer. So it changes. It doesn't change the fact that there's this enormous gauge invariance. It changes the normalization.
How does it depend on k? Replace that n with a k. It's going to be something like k over n minus 1 or something.
Replace n with k. What's k?
Just some number that I put in.
There's independence of.
Independent of anything.
Anything, then that'll just change that'll just change its normalization constant.
Maybe you mean k times little n.
K times little n. Yeah, maybe if you put some k
into it. Integers times e to the.
K minus 1.
K minus 1, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so this you can do, and it changes the normalization of z,
okay.
z. Okay. Good. So just.
The FT have zero dimension?
So the CFT, the ZFT can have dimension zero, yes.
That's Hartle-Hawking.
No, the Hartle-Hawking state corresponds to an ensemble of CFTs with these probabilities. Yeah. Yes. The D equals zero state is not the Hartle-Hawking state. In fact, the Hartle-Hawking state has this non-zero overlap with every state. So just to drive home this gauge invariance, this state, sine of pi z, I can think of this as I do a Taylor expansion of this thing. It's just some complicated linear combination of z to the 1, z cubed, z to the 5th, and so forth, with some coefficients that appear completely random. But if I compute this thing, this turns out to be a null state. It has zero norm. The reason is that if I evaluate this on an integer, I get zero for every integer. So if I take the overlap of this with any state, I get zero. Okay. So that's the null states. And the last thing I'm going to do before handing over to Don is to introduce a tiny bit of extra structure in the model and just tell you what the answer is for those. And it's a similar kind of game. So this extra structure is that I add an additional sort of boundary in the game. And this is not a sort of asymptotically ADS boundary that I impose. Rather, it's some kind of dynamical boundary that is something I have to sum over in the boundary conditions. So these yellow dotted things are what we'll call end of the world brains, following various people. They carry some index, where this index runs from 1 to some number k, and I have to insert these things in boundary conditions. So, for example,
if I compute something psi I psi j, psi j psi I, this thing is defined as a path integral with one boundary over here, with some end of the world brains with labels I and j ending on it, and some other guy over here with end of the world brains labeled I and j ending on it. And I'm now allowed to fill this geometry in any way, but this end of the world brain has to go somewhere, and it has to go somewhere with a matching index. So here, it's, if I is different from j, it's only got one place to go. This only has one place to go, so it connects up, and the geometry looks like this. We have to sum over things like that. So that's the definition of this new theory. I've got new boundaries, and corresponding to the new boundaries, these new things. And if this was a dual CFT, the interpretation of this psi I would be a state that I create with some boundary condition. So this is a nice model for a black hole, where I have some sources that are throwing in matter, and I labels the different states that matter can be in. And then this psi I psi j would be the overlap of these two states, with the inner product. This would be how you compute an inner product with a path integral, but now I can have variances and so forth. Okay. And the last thing to do is to write down the answer for these guys, which is... So I could also throw in some extra boundaries here. I could throw in a z. So this is just a new type of boundary condition. The z still exists. It's a closed boundary. And it can, for example, connect in here with some wormhole, if you like. It doesn't have to. So it's just a new type of boundary condition. I now have k squared plus one different boundary conditions. K squared of these, depending on the indices, and one for the z. Now is about right. Okay, so the game you play for computing these is the same as what we did before. You compute the generating function with this uz that we had before, but you now include a sum over these extra things, Tij, which are like chemical potentials for these new boundaries between end of the world brains of psi j psi I. And you compute a generating function. And this tells you everything you need to know. And I'm going to just write the answer in a suggestive way, which is, okay, I'll normalize things, first of all. And of P D of, let's see, I'll write it somewhere up. Minus lambda and D over D file times E to the U D. So this is the same thing we had before, but then this multiplies something, which is the determinant of 1 minus T to the power of minus D. Okay. So, okay. Look at the paper or ask me afterwards if you want to know how to get this determinant. But the answer in the end is that we get the same thing we did before without these new boundaries. But then each term in the sum has a determinant like this. So I should think of this as a generating function for the conditional probability distribution of this. So this is the generating function of these psi j, psi I boundary conditions, conditioned on z is equal to d. So once I fix myself in a z equals d sector where I know what this dimension of the Hilbert space is, then I can ask what's the probability distribution of these things. It turns out to be given by this. And I can write this in a suggestive way, which is my final equation. Let 1 minus t to the minus d, which is as a Gaussian integral. Products over I is equal to 1 to k products a is equal to 1 to d of 1 over pi psi I a psi I a bar e minus psi I psi I bar, should bring this on. Okay, so I've got this weighting times an exponential of this one. I j equals 1. Should have written this over there. Okay. So this thing is just an ordinary complex Gaussian integral that we see in quantum field theory and so forth all the time. You just have a Gaussian integral, and this is an extra Gaussian. So this is a Gaussian of 1 minus t. This is roughly a Gaussian integral with e to the minus psi dagger 1 minus t psi, but I do it d times because this index a runs over d different things. So the d different integrals labeled by a just all factorize, and you can convince yourself you land on this. So how do I interpret this? Well, I look at the thing this is trying to give me. It's trying to give me this generating function, the expectation value of e to the sort of t dagger psi, if you like. So this is t dagger psi. So what I have to do is identify this thing here with psi j psi I, and I identify this thing with a probability density. So what it means is I have k times d Gaussian variables, and I build the... So I have some set of Gaussian variables. There are... Well, okay, let me draw it. Some set of k times d Gaussian variables that I put in some matrix, and I build the inner products by taking psi dagger psi with this d by k Gaussian matrix. With this d by k matrix. And the crucial fact that Don I'm sure will need is that the rank of this matrix, because it's built from these two k by d matrices, is at most d. And that is, even though this is a k by k matrix, there are k different states I put on the end of the world brains, that can be much, much, much larger than the expected dimension of the Hilbert space, but nonetheless, the path integral is clever enough to truncate this thing to just d states. And these things are basically just, these are the wave functions of the different end of the world brain states, and they're basically chosen uniformly at random from a d-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, so I'm sure there are some questions, but I think that's all I want to say to set Don up. Pending questions. Yeah, one at the back.
Yeah, I have a question about the... Can we promote this Psi, this Psi to an operator? And with this algebra?
Sorry,
I'm thinking, because we can promote like that to an operator, can we do the same for the Psi?
Yeah, so these things here I can think of as Psi J, Psi I. There's an operator. And the eigenvalues of the operator are all things that can be written like this. So that their eigenvalues of these is what they look like in an alpha state, if you like. They all look like an inner product of some matrix, which has, let's get the number of, has k columns and d rows. And this is the transpose of the matrix. Mission conjugate of that matrix. And the entries here are some Gaussian independent.
Suppose you have. Why was the Hilbert space prime dimensional?
So we knew the Hilbert space once we'd fixed ourselves in this particular sector. Then we knew the Hilbert space had to be. Did we? No, we didn't know the Hilbert space had to be. Well, let's see. In fact, the Hilbert space is not finite dimensional. The Hilbert space is a sort of a space of square integrable functions of k times d complex variables. So it's certainly not finite dimensional. The boundary Hilbert space is...
But C is not natural number then.
Sorry, okay, there's two different Hilbert spaces going on here. There's the main Hilbert space we've been talking about is the Hilbert space of baby universes, the Hilbert space of closed universes. That is not finite dimensional. And then there's a different Hilbert space, which is the way we're interpreting the boundary theory. And that has a different Hilbert space, which is finite dimensional. And why is it finite dimensional? It didn't have to be. The fact that we have finite amplitudes certainly suggests that it's finite dimensional. But actually, the bigger mystery is why it has positive dimension, for example.
Or do you have to? It's a fucking
up to. We just have to transition. We'll see whether questions come up.
Good.
Chair.
Please. Okay, thank you very much, Henry, for setting all this up. Henry mentioned at the beginning that there is indeed some connection between all this story and the page curve and the replica wormholes and so forth. I hadn't originally thought to say anything about that, but maybe it's worth drawing out that connection just briefly to make sure it's clear to everyone and bring a little contact back into this. So to repeat what Henry said here at the end, in this more enhanced model, there are these extra sources in the theory that create interesting states in the bulk. And the idea you should have in mind is that for each state of the baby universes, we can apply these sources and create some bulk state that now has an asymptotic boundary. Right? So the size, if you will, create a... I'm just going to tell this story of a connection to page curve in words. I'm not going to try to write things down. The size, as I say, sort of define a state from any baby universe state that has a given structure with an asymptotic boundary. If I take two of those sources, I can combine the states and compute an inner product. And this inner product is exactly what Henry was saying defines an operator in the baby universe Hilbert space. And like all of these operators, it forms part of a complete of a set of commuting operators, so it can be diagonalized in these alpha states. And so you can choose to consider those baby universe states that give you definite numbers for these inner products. And that's the sense in which there's a definite notion of a boundary Hilbert space that comes out. So for each of these alpha states in the baby universe sector, there is some notion of a boundary Hilbert space. Okay. So how does this connect to things like these page curves? Well, the answer is that now that I can create states and compute things with them, I could create, say, something that looks like the maximally mixed density matrix in this boundary Hilbert space. I could use sources I and j to create bras and kets, and I could sum over them in some correlated way. If I then do a computation of Rini entropies for that particular density matrix constructed by hand from certain sources, well, that's some function of these inner products. Okay, because you take trace of rho to the n, you just connect the bras and kets in various ways, each bit is an inner product. So the thing that you would interpret as the Rini entropies of the maximally mixed density matrix in the boundary Hilbert space, say, for any fixed baby universe alpha sector, okay, is again now just some definite number that we can compute. And the point is that as Henry wrote here, the rank of that matrix, the rank of the Hilbert space, the dimension of the Hilbert space, is bounded by this dimension d. And so the idea is that d was the thing that was the value of this z creature. It's basically the circle boundary partition function, if you will. It's the thing which is formally the analog of the Euclidean calculation of a Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It's the disk amplitude, if you will. And so the result is that no matter what Renyi entropies you compute in that boundary Hilbert space, it's always bounded by the analog of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Okay, so that's supposed to be the connection, the sort of replica wormholes. And in fact, if you were to do that calculation, not in an alpha sector, but if you were to do the calculation in the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, which is maybe the easiest thing to do, and if you were to write down the diagrammatic contributions to the path integral that Henry discussed, and if you were to keep only the ones that seemed like they should be the leading order contributions in some semi-classical limit, you'd be writing down the replica wormholes that were studied before, and you'd be writing down, I would produce pictures that look a lot like the ones that appeared in the Stanford paper in particular, because we're using their model and their notation, at least a truncated version of their model. So that is the connection, okay? And one of the things which is interesting, I'll just throw out as a side note, is that you can see from this interpretation, okay, of that calculation, that what's being computed, if I used the Hartle-Hawking state, if I didn't put in a definite alpha sector, is the average of the Renyi entropies over all possible members of the ensemble defined by the Hartle-Hawking state. Okay, that's the interpretation that would come out of this. In particular, you'll notice that with that interpretation, this average Renyi entropy does not in any way include or account for what you might have called entanglement with the baby universe sector. In particular, in this last model Henry wrote down, what this actually says is there's a continuous infinity of these alpha superselection sectors. Okay, each different matrix here that we're integrating over is a different alpha sector. And so if I had written down, if I had defined a state by starting with the Hartle-Hawking state and then doing some operations on it, like adding these sources, okay, it might in fact generate some massive infinite entanglement with the alpha sectors that you just would never see in this calculation. So that's a sort of interesting concept. Okay, so that's how this, in principle, is supposed to relate to the replica wormhole story. Now,
shouldn't it bother us that we have classical variables in the game?
Say that again, please.
We are doing a quantum theory, and we have classical variables in the game.
What classical variables are we talking about, and
psi,
what?
Psi.
Classical variables. I think you're saying that. Should it bother us that all the operators that we have, that Henry and I have defined, commute with each other? Should that bother us? That's your question, I think. Yeah. Okay. So, two things. One is, personally, I think that what this means is that we have not actually written down all of the operators on the baby universe sector, and I think that there's more to be done in that direction. Okay. Second, I can of course say that if we want to think about one of these asymptotic Hilbert spaces, I can then define operators that actually don't commute with each other. Right? I can define the analog of all your favorite CFT operators on the boundary, and they don't commute with each other. All I've really said is that there's a set of superselection sectors for that algebra. Okay? So we can talk about this more later. Should this structure bother us? I think it does mean there's something incomplete about the description I've written down, but I think it's just an incomplete list of the operators, not an incomplete description of the physics, of the Hilbert space. And what I hope is true, okay, is that this structure, that there's some algebra of things that live on the asymptotic boundary, and that there is a set of superselection sectors for that algebra, remains true, even if we include things that describe more of the physics of the baby universes. But that's to be explored. Okay. All right. More on that in 6 months or so after we work out the De Sitter cosmological case. Okay. So this was some comments. What Veronica actually asked us to talk about, or asked me to talk about specifically, was implications of this story for the black hole interior. Okay, so we'll devote the last half hour of the talk or so to that. Okay, now, that's a tall order. There are many questions you could ask about whether this is even, well, okay. You can, I'm going to make some comments. You can decide how seriously to take those comments. Okay? What Henry and I have presented here concretely is an extraordinarily simple model. Right? It has almost no dynamics in it. If we're going to try to extrapolate to more realistic cases, like higher dimensional gravity and so forth, then there are all the issues that were raised at the beginning of the talk. Okay? Our model happens to have some properties that are both wonderful and nothing like what you see in higher dimensions. Okay? Our model has the property that the path integral is well-defined and computable. Okay? Not obviously true in higher dimensions, not true naively in higher dimensions. Maybe there's a way of adding a lot of UV ingredients to make it true. I don't know. Let us set that aside in order to deal with the assigned task of attempting to extrapolate. Okay. The other thing our model did is it defined an ensemble of boundary theories in some sense. Right? Actually, those are the wrong words. What's really true is it defined the spectrum of possible boundary theories. Okay? So, Henry, in this model, you can calculate all of these alpha superselection sectors and find out what is the corresponding inner product. You can then assemble them into any ensemble you like. There's some natural ensemble that comes from the Hartle-Hawking state, but you could have chosen a different baby universe state. There was a different superposition of alpha sectors. You could have chosen a single alpha sector. Okay? You can. Why not? All right. But the point is, in this model, the spectrum of possibilities is calculable, and it yields, yields a spectrum of possibilities. In higher dimensions, it's a bit less clear if this is really the case. In particular, it's slightly confusing to think about this if you try to extrapolate to a case like our favorite examples of ADS CFT involving n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. There's a question of what exactly is the corresponding ensemble that you might think we'd be defining in the bulk. I don't really know at this point, but there are two comments that are worth making. One is that, as Kuhlmann suggested, it's possible that if you could make sense of this structure, there might just be one state of the baby universe theory. Okay, it could be a unique state. My favorite hypothesis at this point, though, is something a little bit different, which is to note that if you give me one way, so what this really is, what a given alpha sector really is a way of assigning, if you like, it's a way of assigning numbers or boundary correlation functions, if you will, to things that really are related to boundary conditions for bulk fields. That's what the psi's are, that's what the z's are. Okay? If you give me one way of writing down boundary conditions for bulk fields and mapping those to correlation functions in, say, n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, then one thing I can always do to make another boundary theory is just to do a bulk field redefinition. In other words, to change that map. So there may be sort of trivial ways, actually, of making an ensemble that would apply to the super Yang-Mills case as well. I don't know. But in any case, in order to have a discussion where we attempt to extrapolate the higher dimensional theories, I'm going to say, let us suppose that your favorite example of ADS CFT is like considering life in a given baby universe alpha state in our model. Okay. All right. Oh, and of course, the third wonderful property this model had is that not only does the path integral converge, but when you compute it, it satisfies this reflection positivity property. It gives you something where the inner product is positive definite. And actually, as was alluded to, that's not a priori guaranteed. We have models that we could write down where we change some parameters. They look just as nice. Actually, in some sense, they might look slightly nicer. And they are not reflection positive. So there you go. All right, but we assume that the right theory of the universe, the right theory which is dual to n equals 4 super A Mills, has some corresponding property where it gives you positive definite Hilbert spaces.
So when you say models, do you mean the action that was assumed?
Yeah, there was some brief commentary here about extra terms you associate with boundaries, and Ahmed mentioned this bit about throwing in a K here. If you throw in a K, I can't remember where, if it's K is bigger than 1 or... Anyway, in general, if K is not, let us say, a positive integer, it turns out that the inner product is not positive definite. Or maybe it's not 1 over a positive integer. I've lost track of my signs. Log of a positive integer. Excuse me. Yes. Yes. E to the K needs to be a positive integer, or else it turns out that the inner product is not positive definite, in a way that I can comment on more in a moment.
But you have a whole set of positive cases.
Absolutely. 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 So the statement is, the model really lives in a general class of models, and reflection positivity picks out a slice through that space. And we've chosen, and we will talk about the nice set. Okay. There we are. Again, presumably, if you find the actual theory you want to discuss, a bulk dual to super Yang Mills, or the theory of the universe, what have you, presumably it's a good case where the inner product is positive definite. And for the sake of this discussion, we will assume that it can be computed in something like this way.
But are you saying JT is not positive definite?
It's not positive definite?
JT doesn't have S0 times NP.
JT is positive definite because it has a... If you have an interpretation, a probabilistic interpretation, it's positive definite.
Right.
If it's positive definite, then there's a probabilistic interpretation.
But there's no this boundary term.
JT has a Schwarzian sector, and we would like to optimistically hope the Schwarzian sector is related to this boundary term. Okay? Obviously, that's an interesting question to flesh out in more detail. But as Henry says, JT, at least in the sense we understand it, in the context where it's dual to double-scaled limit of matrix models, gives you a positive definite answer. Okay, so more details to flesh out. All right. Perhaps also dangerous, Veronica really wanted me to talk about, what... about the experience of someone falling into a black hole. There are no observers in our model, at least not explicitly. So again, I'm going to wildly extrapolate. All right.
So can you not add operators in each of the boundaries or in each of the universes?
I'm not sure what you mean. Yes, okay. We can certainly think about operators that live in the boundary theories.
If you take J to be some field configuration,
yes,
or some scalar field, for example,
yes,
including the metric,
yes,
then you will have some observers in the universe.
This is what I'm effectively going to do.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. So we have degrees of freedom in our model. Okay. So we're going to interpret them as observers and assume that, and just kind of understand what the physics is. All right. So how are we to understand that physics, though? I mean, one of the key properties of this model, right, or all these models, is this set of null states that Henry emphasized, right? And if we're to, I should say, one of the reasons we could attempt to have a discussion about bulk observers in a well-defined way in this model is that it's a model of bulk physics. Right? This is entirely a bulk story, and in the model, the bulk theory is well defined. The path integral converged, Hilbert spaces exist. Okay, we have a lot of structure here. In particular, we can talk about this model without mentioning words like code subspace. You don't have to choose any code subspace. Okay, we don't have to. Right. There's just whatever answer the bulk gives. On the other hand, what it gives us is this confusing story about null states, right? So as I'll one of the things Henry emphasized, so let's look at some examples of null states to get a feel for this. So example one. One of the things Henry emphasized is that even in the simple model without end-of-the-world brains, there's a huge space of null states. And I'll just remind you that there was an equation on the board that was something like this. I'm going to write it, well, where this means that if you expand out this function as a Taylor series, and you think about each Z monomial as being a set of sources for creating states, so there's an equality here. So in other words, the wave function created by a single boundary is the same as the wave function created by a single boundary if you also superpose from k equals 0 to infinity 2 pi to the k plus 1 divided by 2k plus 1 factorial minus 1 to the k, and then this is k circular sources. And so this is the interesting thing here is that, as Henry mentioned, what this tells us is that in some sense the number of connected components of the universe here, even at Euclidean time minus infinity, okay, is not a well-defined observable in the theory. It's not gauge invariant. Right? It's not just that it's not conserved. It's not just that it changes with time, although those things are kind of related in the gravitational theory in a natural way. But even at the fixed time, Euclidean time of minus infinity, this set of components is equivalent to having just one component. So that's interesting. It tells us that a priori, well, it tells us that things that you would have thought are physically different in the bulk somehow aren't. The theory doesn't know the difference between these two states.
If you tweak one of those terms in the sum, like, let's say the coefficient to, you know, multiply it by 1.1 or something,
yep.
I mean, now
you get something
it's
else.
Something different, but is it sort of robustly different, or is it almost, I mean, null state related? Almost gauge.
If you tweak one of the small coefficients by a small amount, then the difference between the left and right sides is small.
But does that mean that now the states are gauge independent?
Well, it means you've done this. You took two states that were identical, okay, and you made them like this. So they're now linearly independent, mm-hmm. But if you go and measure observables, you know, you measure projections or something on those states, if you tweak the coefficients of structure by a tiny bit, it means that with 99.9% probability, you get the same results for both states. So they're almost the same.
Yeah, but if you change each component by a small amount, that probably wouldn't be.
It depends how you change them. It's complicated.
I guess the key underlying point here is that it looks like it's a delicate cancellation that makes these equivalent, not some robust thing.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And the delicacy is certainly important. Yeah, Steve.
So the null states are a property of this theory based on an action involving the Euler number, which is a really simple action. So, you know, when we soup that up to something higher dimensional, which is, you know, Einstein-Hilbert, et cetera, et cetera, you know, what do we expect to transfer over to that case or continue over to that case? Do we have really much information about that?
Let me say a few things. First of all, this is a related discussion, okay? The null states, it was asked before if the null states are something which are intrinsically very quantum mechanical or something that follow immediately from diffeomorphism invariants. Right. And the answer is, Henry mentioned that, of course, at some level, the path integral is calculating things related to diffeomorphism invariants. But the real answer is that, you know, in these models, you can do the calculation. These null states do appear from very quantum mechanical effects. They come from really summing over all these instantons and so forth, and you get these magic zeros. Now, ask
a special model, but
you would like to it's a great question what happens more generally. The comment I want to make is this. And this is why I paused to make a connection with these replica wormholes. Okay? In this kind of model, the replica wormhole answer that the boundary Rényi entropies are bounded in terms of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy comes from this kind of bound. If this wasn't true, And especially if it wasn't true sort of generically in the Hartle-Hawking ensemble, then in this kind of calculation, you wouldn't get that answer. And that's a very nice answer. Okay? So if you like that answer, okay, there is strong motivation to believe in these null states. I will give you a separate axiomatic argument in a moment, depending on the length of Davis' question. Yes?
Something that bothers me about you illustrate a very simple null state. It looks to me like, unless you know something about asymptotic lead events, the continuous infinity of such states.
Yeah?
That doesn't bother me.
I just constructed the Hilbert space. I mean, I agree that finding these null, this is an important point.
So in other words, you take this, multiply that sign by any polynomial in Z.
Yeah.
And that gives you, with any number of continuous variables.
Yeah.
And a hell of a lot of null states.
This is true. The model has a hell of a lot of null states. Okay. So I want to give this abstract argument because there are two different things. One is the question of, can you actually find the null states? A separate question is, do you know that they exist? Okay? And so there's an abstract argument that I would like to suggest. Well, the abstract argument at some level tells us that if you have a path integral which satisfies our axioms that somehow makes sense and gives you a positive definite inner product, there will be a lot of null states. Okay? So let's just go through how that works because I think it's enlightening. Now, of course, you could take the perspective that our axioms are too strong and that the real path integral at higher dimensions doesn't have all those wonderful properties. I don't know. But then I don't know what the theory is because So what's the axiomatic argument I'd like to give? All right. In the paper, we have some very general version of this argument, which applies in the context where the boundary theory is infinite dimensional, and we can deal with that in various ways by looking at what are effectively microcanonical ensembles and so forth. But let me just give you the argument in a simple context where the boundary theory is effectively finite dimensional. Okay? If you like, you could think I'm applying it in some slight generalization of this model. All right. So here's the idea. But for the sake of argument, I will draw you pictures, and actually they're in some sense easier to draw, that live in higher dimensions. Okay. So let's consider what you might call the one boundary sector of the theory. And by this, I mean one boundary that looks like this, where we're going to do sources in the past and future. One asymptotic boundary, maybe one boundary sector with baby universes. So one boundary in addition to the baby universes. Okay? All right. And actually, what I should really say is we're going to do one boundary sector with a fixed alpha state from the baby universe sector, just for simplicity for the moment. All right. So I'm going to, okay. The point is this. From the dual CFT point of view, we're used to the idea that you could talk about the cylinder path integral preparing the thermal field double state. Okay? So let's write that down. If this has some beta, we're used to thinking of this as e to the minus beta h over 2, or beta e over 2, e, e, e. Okay. So what I want to do is use a bulk version of this. Okay, or show you that there is something like a bulk version of this, and that it leads to the existence of null states in the bulk. So what do I mean by that? I guess I just jumped ahead a little bit, because this now involves the two-boundary sector. But this was a prelude. So here. forget this. Let's go back to the one boundary sector, okay? And suppose that in this one boundary sector, I have a complete list of sources. A complete list of all possible sources that I could add to a single boundary. Okay. Well, for each source, I can create a state. And so let me start with the simplest state. I will draw a higher dimensional picture. Maybe I'm computing something like a disk amplitude, the thing we would usually think of as giving the vacuum of ADS, something like that. So in general, this will be some state. It has some norm in the given alpha sector. It's presumably not zero, so I'll list it as a state. Now I'll take the next source, which maybe the next source is something like, I don't know, maybe it's got a little handle on it, maybe it's got some scalar fields, who knows, it's the next source. Okay. In general, in a general alpha sector, this will be a state which is linearly independent of the original state. So I could combine the two with some coefficients. Here, I'll put some coefficient there, some coefficient here.
I don't really understand what you, how you're distinguishing these as different sources. I thought sources were like boundary conditions on the boundary.
They are. Here I've chosen different boundary methods.
Same boundary. You're drawing a bulk.
No. This is the boundary metric.
So it's different boundary topology?
Different boundary topology, okay. Say. It doesn't really matter. It would have been just as good to choose same boundary topology and add some insertions of scalar sources. My point is just some different boundary condition.
Okay.
So let me suppose that I have some complete list of boundary conditions, and my point is that I can go through some kind of Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization procedure to define from this a list of states which are, in fact, orthonormal in the given alpha sector. Okay.
Sorry, right. Question?
Yes.
If you were doing this, in the old version of ADS-DFT, you could also do that, right? And that would just be the energy eigenstates, right? You could always decompose any state, that any excited state that you prepare as a linear combination of energy.
You could choose them to be linear energy eigenstates. Here I haven't even done that. I just want them to be some orthonormal states. But yes, you could choose them to be energy eigenstates.
But does the story change now if you're in the alpha sector, the way to think about that?
Well, I guess the point is that in our story, if you haven't chosen a definite alpha sector, then there's not a definite inner product between these states. So I don't know which coefficients to use. I don't know how to Gram-Schmidt orthogonalize them until I choose a given alpha sector. Okay, so let me do that for definiteness.
You don't have to, it just makes it easier.
No, you...
Gram-Schmidt the whole alpha, same time. What, you'd reconstruct the alpha sectors.
You could reconstruct the alpha sectors, okay? But if you fix the baby universe state, it's easier to do it in alpha sector. So let's just do that. Okay. In particular, the bound I want to derive requires me to be in an alpha sector. All right. So here's a complete list of sources. Great. So we've enumerated some states. And now let's consider the two boundary sector. Well, okay. In the two boundary sector, there are some states that are just the tensor product of two of the states in the one boundary sector. And for various reasons, it's kind of nice to CPT conjugate one of these sources. All right. So here's a list of some states that exist in the two boundary sector. And the point is that because we chose an alpha sector, the inner product here is easily computable from this inner product. Okay. It follows immediately that, again, I get just deltas. Maybe I should write that down. If I call this the state ij star, then the inner product, I1 J star 1 with I2 J star 2 in an alpha sector is indeed delta I1 I2 delta J1 star J2 star. Okay, so here's a bunch of states. Now, there's another state that lives in the two-boundary sector, which is this creature. It's the state which is defined by what's effectively a kind of a cylinder boundary condition. Okay? And I'm going to consider a model which, as I say, has a finite number of states. So maybe I don't care what beta is. Maybe it's a model which is topological, much like ours. So you should just think of all the states as having zero energy anyway. So who cares what beta is? All right. So I'm going to talk about the cylinder here. I'm going to draw it as a cylinder, but it has zero length. It's some boundary condition for this theory. All right. So that exists as a state. Now, the interesting question is, what is the inner product between the states I've already written down in the two-boundary sector and this beta equals zero cylinder? Okay. Well, what Henry taught us was that the recipe for this is to compute some kind of path integral where you take the given bits of boundary conditions, which are whatever I is, whatever j is, and whatever this cylinder is, and you're supposed to sew all these together in the same way that over here, see, here is the first part, here's the second part, you sew them together into one boundary. So, and here the sewing is supposed to be on each component separately, so I1 gets sewn here, j gets sewn there, okay? But this is a cylinder of zero length. So all I've done is really stick together the I1 and J1 star boundary conditions with a, quote, zero-length cylinder in the middle. Well, if you add a zero-length cylinder here, I extend this circle upward by a distance of zero, it doesn't change anything. So this is, in fact, manifestly the same as the inner product of I with J, like so, which is delta I1, J1. Okay, so all I've done is repeat in this sort of abstract language calculations that, as has been noted, we would have done in the boundary CFT and ADS CFT to start to see relations between the cylinder propagator in the CFT and a correlated sum of energy states. All right. But if we use those relations, we find the following. Oops, I don't want to erase this. The said rank of psi. Great. So let's do the following. I want to compute the norm of a state defined by taking the beta equals zero cylinder and subtracting off the sum from I equals 1 to however many linearly independent sources I could enumerate. So let's say this is the dimension of the one boundary sector. And these are the states I star. So I'll choose the diagonal states. And let's compute the norm. Okay. So what do I get? Well, if I put two of these together, that just gives me this torus diagram. This is effectively the thing that was called Z in the model, so I'll just call it Z. We're in an alpha sector, so this is now some number. Okay. Let me not yet presume it's a positive integer, but it's some number. That's the norm of this state. The cross terms are easy. The cross terms are just this with this. That's this inner product for I equals J, which is 1. So there's whatever is, I guess I need a name for this dimension. No, I'll just call it dimension of H 1 boundary. Okay, so this with this gives me this answer. Of course, there's the other cross term where I take the, the factor of 2. I get to use this once as a bra and once as a ket. Okay, and then there's the term where I take the norm of this state. But that's easy because this is just a sum of some number of orthonormal states. And so its norm is given by the sum of 1 this many times. So it's a similar factor, and it cancels this. So the answer is this, z minus the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay. So now, obviously, if reflection positivity is satisfied, if our inner product is positive, this thing is non-negative, right? And so what this tells us is that if this torus partition function, if the analog of our Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is finite, then the dimension of this one boundary Hilbert space must also be finite. So it tells us that in a context where the, if you like, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is finite, if our axioms hold, then if you thought you had a very long list of sources that could apparently create more states in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, you were wrong. Okay? This dimension is, in fact, smaller than Z. Okay? And how could you have been wrong? Well, there must have been null states there. So this is the general argument that if the higher dimensional path integral can be UV completed in some way so that it computes well-defined positive inner products and makes sense, that these null states will appear and then reproduce something like the replica wormhole story. And I've listed the ifs, and you can decide what to believe. So, you know, I was, as I said, we were asked to comment on implications for the black hole interior. I haven't really said that yet. We were also out of time. Right? But what I have emphasized is the importance of these null states and the fact that there's an axiomatic argument that suggests that they really do appear in general. And moreover, I can flesh out more of this in various ways, but it suggests that this equivalence between states defined by a cylinder path integral and states defined by correlated sums over geometries that Juan taught us to know and love many years ago, it suggests that that should be thought of as an example of this bulk gauge equivalence. Okay? And so here's an example again where naively, the bulk physics is very different. And there's even a sharp argument that it really is different. Okay, Aaron Wall and I wrote some paper years ago about super selection sectors based on this, and our basic point was that you could confuse yourself into thinking that these two sides aren't very different, but our basic point is that if you can build bulk gravitational observables using the standard kind of gravitational dressing that we're used to, then these states really are different. So now having concluded that the states really are the same in the bulk, in our gauge equivalent, what it tells you then is that using our familiar ideas about gravitational dressing does not suffice to define a gauge invariant observable in the bulk. So now if you ask me to extrapolate from this about what happens in the interior of a black hole, especially an old black hole, well, I'm tempted to say, I'm going to say this, and then you can ask questions for as long as you like, okay? I'm tempted to say that the answer is not well-defined in any familiar sense, that the kind of answers we're used to wanting appear to not be gauge-invariant concepts inside the black hole. This is either horrible or wonderful, depending on your perspective, okay? On the one hand, it sounds, I don't know what, it sounds a little bit crazy. I will mention that it can be wonderful because this idea has finally allowed me personally to come to terms with all of these discussions about state dependence, code subspaces, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which we could discuss and review, but there are various amounts of, I will use the word arbitrariness, that go into those discussions, okay? I can now live with that if I decide that all the different answers I could get by using different constructions of code subspaces, state-dependent operators, etc., many of which are admittedly very complicated, making use of those fine-tuned cancellations we discussed before, okay, I can make myself happy with that arbitrariness if I believe they're giving me things that are a priori different in the bulk, but in fact gauge equivalent. And I could make myself happy by believing that those different things I could do effectively amount to different ways of gauge fixing the bulk. Okay. That doesn't feel wonderful. On the other hand, if you ask me, what do I really feel if I jump into a black hole, then I have to have more time to talk. So I'm going to stop here. And of course, I'm happy to talk more to anyone who wishes or attempt to answer any questions after I'm done.
Are you saying that that question is ill-posed?
I think the question is ill-posed, which, you know, at some level, that's the answer we've been telling ourselves for years, okay? I think that, you know, to a certain extent, we've been trying to make ourselves feel better about the idea by mentioning that maybe ideas of complexity would tell us that at least in certain situations, there are only certain answers we can get with simple descriptions and so forth. But this makes me happy with the idea that it's intrinsically ill-posed, okay? So here seems to be an example of here's a state. We can describe it in two different gauges. We can describe it in the two-boundary gauge, or we can describe it in the product of one-boundary gauges, okay? And if you ask me what happens to you if you fall into this black hole, I'm tempted to say, well, in the two-boundary gauge, there's one answer. In the product of one boundary gauges, there's a different answer.
That's the opposite of what you did with by gauge, right? The different gauges are supposed to give us the same physical
Exactly. No, it's a matter of semantics.
We can ask. We could do the traversable wormhole protocols,
yeah,
and ask the person what they felt. And no matter how we describe it, they would tell you the same thing.
Exactly, which is why this is an example of the usual gauge invariant story. If you ask a well-defined question, one that lives, well, in this case, these things that lived at the boundary were gauge invariant operators. Z is gauge invariant, this is gauge invariant, all those things. All the things that are boundary operators are manifestly gauge invariant. If you translate your question to something about the boundary operators, then no matter what intermediate description you gave, you'll get the same answer for the boundary operators.
Right, so if I threw in some observer by acting on an operator on the ADS boundary,
yeah,
and that thing fell in, that should have a gauge invariant experience as it falls through the...
So this is the part that I think is not the right set of words. Okay? I mean, I agree that I sound crazy. I agree that you know, the essence of the argument in the paper with Aaron Wall about super selection sectors, the essence of a lot of the firewall stuff and so forth, is to take exactly the point of view that you just espoused. Okay? And I'm now just saying the model doesn't support that. The model suggests something else. The model suggests that there is something we can call the gauge invariant physical answers, but they're only answers that respect this notion of null states. Whereas the natural notion of something we might have thought of as an observer in this model, okay, doesn't seem to respect that notion.
Are you saying your observations are gauge invariant?
Right here in this room where I'm not in a black hole, I don't have reason to doubt that.
Wait, which direction?
I have no reason to doubt that my observations fail. I see. I have no reason to believe.
Are they gauge invariant or not?
Right now, I believe my observations are gauge invariant.
Okay. But if you fall into a black hole, it's different.
Well, it depends what you mean. No. I want to do it this way. I want to say this. Let's make it your observations instead of mine. Into the black hole, okay? Which Steve Giddings operator are we talking about?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm going to perform a gauge transformation on you. Okay, you feel different.
I think
so. Transformations don't change.
Whatever is physical. Well, the question is, what you mean by that? Let me put it this way. So if I want to talk about the value of the X component of the potential in electromagnetism, okay, then in general, that's not a gauge invariant operator, right? Okay. But if I want to talk about the value of the X component in Coulomb gauge, that defines a gauge invariant operator. if I want to define the value of the x component in axial gauge, that defines a gauge invariant operator.
Which are non-local.
Fine. Non-local. Okay. So all of those questions, the value of the operator in some gauge, those define gauge invariant operators. They all have, you know, good answers. What the model suggests, and you can take from that what you will, is that if we want to ask the question, what does Steve Giddings experience, we have to decide. Do we want the Steve Giddings operator in the two-boundary gauge or in the other gauge? In other words, it suggests that there are that to really define a full gauge invariant operator describing you, we need some additional inputs that we wouldn't have expected by thinking about your physics in simple space-times where quantum gravity effects are not large. If I say it that way, it's not a surprise. You know, we have some idea of what a Steve Giddings operator is within this framework of the standard model in Minkowski space. Some vague idea. Okay, Steve is a complicated person. But if I then say, what is the Steve Giddings operator in a context where space-time is fluctuating a lot, quantum gravity effects are important, it's not so obvious what the answer is. This is, in a way, just a version of that problem, saying that maybe there's a lot of different ways to take the operator from the regime we understand and extrapolate it into this more complicated regime. Okay? And there you go.
We could say there can be different dressings which correspond to different physically gauges.
But the question is, what's a sufficient amount of dressing? It was argued here that the standard dressings we use are not sufficient. So, yeah.
So, the CMB spectrum, is that gauge?
I don't know. The whole question about how to extrapolate this to cosmology is something I wish to understand better.
Well, I can imagine that the correlators, right, in this closed universe.
Exactly.
So, and you say, not to one universe, I can, like, million universe, I've got same CMB correlators.
I missed that again. What was that?
Well, I just want to...
My point is, I want to stand by the fact that I do not fully understand what to say about closed universes at this point. So I don't know. Right. Gary.
Do you think there's any gauge invariant operators inside an old black hole?
Yes. Okay. Can I tell you what they are?
Sure.
No. Saying what they are, and maybe there's not. Okay, I mean, at some level, well, all right. At some level, there are the stupid operators. Like each boundary source that creates some black hole interior clearly defines a gauge invariant operator, which is a projection onto the associated state. Is that a useful description? I don't know. Now, I don't know if this is going to make people feel better or worse, but I have to say it. Okay, so I feel like this is. Maybe it would make you feel, I don't know if it would make you feel better or worse, but the claim is that in some sense there are lots of different gauges you could consider inside the black hole, and therefore lots of different operators that might describe Steve, okay? But in fact, what we're told here from this story is that, you know, you write down the naive Hilbert space. The actual Hilbert space is something that is much smaller, and as was written on the blackboard before, it's constructed by essentially some random subspace, the original one. Okay? And so in the original subspace, maybe there's Steve inside the black hole. How many other things would be inside the black hole? There's a lot of states that would be inside a black hole. Most of them are not much fun to experience. Right? Okay. So in fact, there's a sense in which if you wrote down the generic gauge, I think you might find that the answer is that whoever fell into the black hole doesn't actually exist because they're part of some highly interacting soup of stuff. Maybe that makes you feel better about the fact that there's not a preferred gauge. I don't know. Okay. We could go on forever. I don't know when. Veronica promised she was going to cut me off at some point. But she wants to ask a question, so.
Okay, it's a quick one. How did this being inside old black hole crop up in sort of your derivation?
Oh, good. So, as the parent here, okay, a generic state is not null. You write down any boundary condition you like, it creates some state. It's generally not null. It might have small norm, but it's not null. Where do you start to really see the appearance of null states and therefore the gauge equivalence? It's when you have a long list of states that you want to compare. How many contexts are there where we really believe you can generate a list of states inside a black hole where the list of states exceeds the Beckinsale-Hawking entropy? Well, the answer is the most natural such context is the old black hole where you're just evaporating for a long time, you have these very deep throats. That's a context that naturally leads to this. Okay, so that's a context where this would be especially manifest.
All right, so I guess we can have further discussion informally. Thanks.